believe that he did. Out, Max Patterson had a bachelor's degree in public administration and a master's degree in public administration. He was hired as a result of this screening committee in this nationwide search and came to Beaumont in early 1986, moved to Beaumont, bought a house, and became a Beaumont citizen. In November of 1986, Al Haynes decided that the chief of police of Beaumont at that time, John Swan, was doing an ineffective job, and the morale was low. So he asked for John Swan's resignation. Then in early December of 1986, he decided to appoint Max Patterson as interim police chief for the time being until a new permanent police chief could be appointed. This was in addition to his job as Department of Resource Management. This was done, as I say, in early December 1986. He decided, and he wrote a letter to the mayor, the city council, to the police department, stating that he was doing this because he did not believe that anybody should have the inside track for the permanent police job. And therefore, he was appointing Max Patterson because he was just a temporary or interim police chief. In January of 1987, specifically January the 19th of 1987, the entire staff department of the police, 21 officers, held a press conference on the steps of the Beaumont Police Building in Beaumont and gave a statement to the press. And in this statement, they told the press and the public that they were there to talk about two things. They were wanted to talk about the operation of the police department under Max Patterson, and secondly, the selection of the next permanent police chief. That starts off their press conference. Then they talked about how they thought that morale was low because of some of the actions of Max Patterson, what he had been doing as interim police chief in the last 6 weeks. They also stated that they thought that the city manager, Al Haynes, should select a blue ribbon committee to screen out and appoint someone for permanent police chief. That was their concern, is who was going to be selected the permanent police chief. Now, when this press conference was held, Al Haynes, city manager, saw it for the first time on news and became visibly upset. The next day, he had a meeting, and you need to know that this press conference was signed by all 21 members of the police staff, not just the five plaintiffs, but all 21 members.
When you say signed, they attended, or they had a formal?
They had a formal press conference. I do not know if all of them were present at that press conference, but all 21 members signed.
So whatever statement was issued.
Whatever statement was issued to the press.
Under the whistleblower statute, the requirement that the report has to be the appropriate law enforcement agency. Do you concede, or is there any argument here that if they've been fired because they held a press conference, that in any way implicates the whistleblower statute?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Judge.
Well, there's a discussion throughout that they're making claims of violation of whistleblower statute, but the whistleblower statute is only implicated if there's a report to a proper law enforcement agency for a violation of the law. There's no protection for just out of whistleblower just because you hold press conferences.
I think that's correct. I think you have to report to someone with proper enforcement authority. Now, I do concede that I believe Al Haynes, the city manager, had authority to rectify whatever grievances they had. I would like
and that report was made to him prior to holding the
No, it was not made. The first time he learned about it was when he saw the 6 o'clock meeting.
So there's no question that if they were fired for holding the press conference, it doesn't implicate the whistleblower statute.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. But furthermore, more importantly, it doesn't implicate the whistleblower conference because there's nothing in there that talks about either the whistleblower statute or what this, quote, alleged violation. What they are saying now is that Max Patterson, they thought, was going to be the Beaumont police chief, and he was not a citizen of Beaumont. The city charter of Beaumont says that qualifications being equal, citizens of Beaumont shall be given preference in hiring. That's what the city charter says. Qualifications being equal. Now, I would like the court to understand that nobody has ever compared the qualifications of Max Patterson, who had been a police chief up in Windsor, Connecticut, with anyone else. And this was, I don't think you'll find that in any of the records. They said, well, we didn't think he was qualified, but nobody has ever said it. Their whole concern at that time was that they were afraid that Max Patterson was going to be appointed the permanent police chief.
At that time, had he already lived there a certain amount of time?
There's nothing, Judge Specter, that says he had to live there any specific time. It just says citizens of Beaumont.
But he'd already moved there.
Oh, yes. He had moved there, bought a home, set up residence, and so on.
Within Beaumont.
Absolutely, Judge Specter. So he was there. And the reason that they were concerned, and we will get, is that Max Patterson was black. And there had never been a black police chief in Beaumont. And this is, in the city attorney, Lane Nichols, who tried this lawsuit, asked one of them, well, what is all this thing about race? And he said, because Beaumont's never had a black police chief. And their lawyer, Ted Walker, wrote a letter to the mayor and the city council. And he talked about that this is an opportunity, that you're trying to make an opportunity to appoint a permanent police chief based on race. And he talked about affirmative action concepts. And this was the crux of this lawsuit. This is the genesis of this lawsuit. They did not want a permanent police chief that was black. And that's the reason for the Batson challenge. That's what Mr. Black will discuss. But anyway, after this press conference on January the 19th, the next day that Al Haynes, no question, was visibly upset, met with him, and then decided to rectify the situation. And what he did was he wrote a letter to the four majors, who were four of the five plaintiffs in this lawsuit, and said, look, we're going to change things. I'm going to try to address your concerns. And he wrote, and this letter is in the record. And what he said is first of all, there's not going to be any operative decisions made without the major's approval and my approval. Number two, I'm going to turn over. Your concern is with Max Patterson, and I'm going to turn over, and the way he's been operating the department for the last 6 weeks, so I'm going to turn over the operational decisions of the department to the majors. Then Max Patterson will continue to do his other duties, but the operational decisions are going to be the majors. He said, number three is that I'm going to have weekly staff meetings with the four majors, police chief, Max Patterson, and myself. And we're going to have weekly meetings so that I know what's going on in the police department and you tell me what's going on. Now, and then finally, to address their concern, their second concern about the selection of police chief, he said, I'm going to appoint a blue ribbon committee, as you had asked for, to screen the candidates. And in fact, that's exactly what he did. He appointed the councilman. He appointed former city manager Ray Riley, who now happens to be the city manager again. He appointed various people to screen the candidates. And he also said that this Blue Ribbon Committee shall make the final group of people to submit to me, but the majors, if they apply, they're going to be on that list. He ultimately appointed somebody from within the department, George Shook, who signed the press statement along with everybody else. So was there retaliation? This is ridiculous. Absolutely no ridiculous. The other members who signed it are not claiming retaliation. The only people claiming retaliation are the four majors and the captain. Now, that's their first act, their press conference. The second thing that they say was that 2 weeks later, at one of these weekly staff meetings with the majors, they brought their attorney, and a court reporter. And this upset Al Haynes, because this was one of their regularly scheduled weekly staff meetings. And he thought that was inappropriate. Told himself, it's in the record as to what he was said in the conversation. He said, I'll discuss it with you guys later, but we're going to have the staff meeting first, and then if y'all want to have this lawyer later, I'll be happy to meet with you. And that's in the record. But he then wrote a reprimand two days later, on February the 5th. That was February the 3rd. February the 5th of 87, he wrote a written reprimand to the four majors. Those are the two acts that they claimed that they were attempting to blow the whistle. Whatever, I'm not sure what that is, but they were attempting to blow the whistle. And in consequence, they were retaliated. They said they were retaliated because they got a written reprimand. That was the first act, February the 5th of 87, that the new police chief, Captain Schultz, reorganized the department. Three of the majors, Four of the majors said that they got reduced responsibilities. The fifth plaintiff, Captain Carter, said he got increased responsibilities as a result of this reorganization. So they're all claiming that that was retaliation because their duties changed.
Retaliation for what?
I'm not sure, Justice Gonzalez. Retaliation, I guess, for complaining about what was happening. But he was really complaining about Max Patterson, not that this was a violation, because nobody complained when he moved down to Beaumont and with the Department of Resources. It's only when he started operating the police department that they began complaining. And I don't think you will see in either the press statement or anything else, you will see they're talking about a violation of the law or violation. You won't see the city charter mentioned one time. But that's what they're now, that's what they told the jury, and that's what they're now telling this court.
Mr. Counselman, the city objected to the trial court's failure to accept evidence on the juror strikes.
That's correct.
From the first trial.
That's correct.
And the response has been, well, that was just cumulative because the trial judge knew that they'd struck all the black jurors from the first trial. What makes this error, failing to allow the city to elaborate on these strikes from the first trial, makes that harmful error?
Well, Your Honor, I think Mr. Black is going to address that point if the judge...
No, I'm sorry, I'll ask him.
He, if you ask him, I would appreciate that, Your Honor. I could answer, but I think he could do it better. But...
How are we doing? Fine.
Yes. Now, the thing about it is in fact, they claim that they were demoted from majors to captains. And now they claim that they were constructively terminated. Four of the plaintiffs claim they were constructively terminated. I would like to first say that there is no, their claim under Article 1, Section 8, the Constitution part, we believe that there is no such law in Texas. The two principal cases are Bagg versus University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston, which holds there is no state constitutional tort. And then the second one is Albertson versus Ortiz, which came out last year out of the Austin Court of Appeals. This Supreme Court denied writ last December involving that very question, is there a state constitutional tort under Article 1, Section 8? And this court has denied that writ and I think upheld that there is no state constitutional tort. So that theory of their liability goes out of the lawsuit, I think. The second theory is the whistleblower statute, and I don't think there is any violation of the whistleblower statute at all. Because as I say, number one, Max, it is because Max, first of all, it was their complaint about the permanent police chief, and in fact, George Shultz was appointed a permanent police chief. Their complaint is that, well, Max Patterson was appointed an interim police chief, that's their complaint. When he was appointed that, he was a resident of Beaumont, and nobody ever asked about his qualifications vis-a-vis somebody else. And that's what the city charter requires. Now, finally, in constructive termination, unlike the previous case at the Hind, this is one where four of the five plaintiffs here are claiming they were constructively terminated. And under the law, there's only one Texas case that I can find, and that's Polly Hammond versus KDN Peniscuda District at 821 Southwest 2nd 174 out of the Houston Court of Appeals with no red history in 1991. The idea of constructive termination was first came up in unfair labor practice cases. Later, it was transferred over to employment discrimination cases where somebody was terminated, said they were constructively discharged because of their race or their sex or their religion. And now it's being embodied into this one. And the courts, what the Hammond Court, and they adopted it for the Fifth Circuit, what they have said is that constructive termination, and the court properly gave the proper charge in this case, said that an employee, the conditions must be so intolerable that a reasonable employee would feel compelled to resign. Now that's the test, that's the law. That's the law pretty well accepted all over the country. Let me just quickly state to you that four of these plaintiffs that are claiming constructive termination, one captain, three majors, the captain was never demoted because he was not a major. He admitted he was never disciplined. He was never reduced in rank. He was never fined a day in his life. And he took early retirement in February of 1989, 2 years after these alleged acts. And That's what he signed was that he was taking early retirement, and he checked on the employee exit interview form, and each one of these plaintiffs signed one of these forms. They were voluntary, involuntary, or discharged with a cause. And each one of them checked voluntary retirement. Each one of them applied on a separate form for early retirement and received a bunch of money on this thing. So the captain who suffered none of this discrimination is claiming constructive discharge. The three majors that are claiming constructive termination, I'd like to point out that Major Parsons, one of those majors, did not file a grievance with the union, although he could have. He accepted the early retirement form, and he checked voluntary retirement. Major Rush, who also checked the same form of early retirement, said, they asked him what was the most positive aspect of his job. He said, feeling that he was performing a necessary function, and that he would recommend the city of Beaumont as an employer to others. Now, does that sound like he was compelled to resign? Major Curricone, who also checked the voluntary retirement and took early retirement in February of 89, on his employee exit interview form, checked voluntary, checked retiring, he said, what were the most negative aspects of your job? And here's his answer. Can't think of any. They asked him, how did they rate the aspects of his job? He said, good to excellent. And then he said, would you recommend the city of Beaumont as an employer to others? He said, yes. Did that feel like he was compelled to resign? I submit no. Now, the final straw that I would like to point out is that Major Bouillon, who suffered the same acts that everyone else did, is still working for the city of Beaumont today. The reason is he could not take early retirement. So obviously, what's the reasonable person and who's the reasonable person? And I submit that Major Bouillon is a reasonable person because he did not take it because he couldn't take it early retirement. Thank you.
She doesn't have that power.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's probably a very excellent point. My name is Bob Black. I'm going to address the Batson point. And let me start off just by addressing your question about the Court of Appeals holding that this evidence was cumulative on the first trial strikes. Our point is that evidence is not cumulative in any way because it establishes a pattern of conduct on the part of the plaintiff's trial counsel. It was the same trial counsel in both cases that is illustrative of the pretextual nature of his race-neutral explanations given at the Batson hearing. And that's why it's not cumulative. And in fact, we don't know whether the trial court remembered or even knew whether the first jury, that the plaintiff had used all of his strikes. Moreover, the trial court specifically stated at page 144 that he refused to consider any evidence at all concerning the first trial. Now, at the Batson hearing,
has this court written on Batson since the United States Supreme Court has applied it in civil cases?
It has in the Davenport versus Garcia case, but on a different point. They have not written on the Batson logic of about a Batson hearing or following through on Palacios versus Powell. They have not addressed the point since that time. At the Batson hearing, there were four witnesses called. The plaintiff called George Kirk, their trial lawyer, to bring forth race-neutral explanations. We then called the city's trial lawyers at the time, Joe Sanders and Lane Nichols, as well as one of the excluded jurors, Sandra LaBeouf, to establish that the explanations given were pretextual in nature. A critical point was this evidence from the first trial that the plaintiff's attorney had seven strikes and used all seven to exclude blacks. And moreover, the one black who made it on the first panel ultimately was one of the three dissenting jurors who hung the first trial. Then at this trial, the plaintiff struck all five blacks. There were only five on the panel available for selection. Struck all five blacks. So 12 out of 14 during the two different cases, 12 out of 14 strikes were used to exclude blacks.
So we feel the characterization of the plaintiff used 100% of the peremptory challenges to strike blacks.
That's correct. And it's not just one because there was one African-American on the panel. It's 12. And while they make a major point of the Hernandez versus New York case saying that disparate impact is not in and of itself sufficient to sustain a Batson objection, the point is Hernandez holds that that evidence is admissible. Batson and Keaton v. State, decided by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, both hold that critical evidence, which weighs heavily, according to Keaton, too, is pattern of past conduct. And we cannot fail to look at that, and that's why that first trial evidence was so important to help illustrate the pretextual nature of those strikes.
Regardless of merits of your argument, did you preserve error on this Batson claim all the way to this court?
I believe we did, Mr. Chief Justice. First of all, the challenge was timely made at the time of the second trial, and that's at pages 3, 8, and 9 of the Supplemental Statement of Facts. The question that they have raised is whether the objection was timely made at the trial itself. At page 3, it states that...
Well, regardless of the trial court, I mean, the Appeal of Appeals Court sent it back for a Batson hearing.
That's correct. And we have appealed back to the Court of Appeals the trial court's Batson resolution, and we have appealed to this court, and the court has granted writ of error on points 1 and 4, which are Batson points. Yeah, I believe that it's fully preserved in terms of the timeliness. The only other possible issue where it might not be preserved is the Bill of Exceptions, and the Court of Appeals specifically held in its opinion that, at page 18, that we had properly preserved it, and that the only fair reading of the record was that the court had ruled on it, and the plaintiffs below have not cross-appealed or have not filed anything in any way to contest the Court of Appeals ruling. That may have been the only favorable point of the Court of Appeals opinion for us, but they did specifically hold that the Bill of Exceptions was properly preserved. They went on to hold that the evidence was cumulative, as you note, Justice Enning. I'd like to move on to a discussion of the findings of fact, which I think are very important here, because the standard for reviewing those is whether they're clearly erroneous. I have isolated in the brief, and we'll hear very quickly, the points that are so important. Finding 12 of those findings of fact states what the plaintiff's strategy was in striking the jurors. Finding 12 bears no resemblance to what that lawyer testified to at the Batson hearing. I urge you to contrast finding 12 with his testimony at pages 12 and 13. There are several additional theories and strategies put in there. And this carries through because finding 12 is a predicate for the later exclusion of each of these jurors. And most specifically and importantly, the strike of Sandra LaBeouf, we feel, was clearly based upon race. In that finding, first of all, it refers to finding 12, which we know was not important. And second, it simply goes on to say that she was questioned and this sort of thing when we know the record says that she was not. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May I say important, Holman has done argument for the respondents.
Please, the court. I would like to present my argument in three portions. A third be devoted to the evidentiary problem issue that was raised. A third to be devoted to the Batson issue, and then a third to the final constitutional cause of action, which is our alternative theory of recovery, alternative to the whistleblower findings that we secured from the jury. The case is one where men of unquestioned integrity, police officers, majors who had risen to the rank through competitive examination, two of whom had a master's degree, two others had college degrees, one of whom didn't have a college degree but who had been to college, over 150 years of combined experience, the leadership of the Beaumont Police Department was cut off in a series of actions by the city manager, Mr. Haynes. The question for the jury was, why did this occur?
Mr. Coleman, would it be fair to say that none of your clients wanted a black chief?
No, sir. That would not be fair to say. The clients never complained that they didn't want a black chief. They were complaining about the process of selecting the chief. They made two reports. Their complaint at the press conference was to the effect that city management is again dictating a selection process that precludes the process, the possibility of the chief being chosen from within the department or a local chief. They have observed several appointments that had been made, including Mr. Patterson's appointment as resource manager, without there having been any persons from Beaumont having been considered. There was a personnel department position that came open. A person from outside the city was chosen for that and appointed without local persons having the opportunity. There was a secretary's position that came open, again filled by an outsider. They saw these things happening. They saw Patterson being brought in as resource manager and then appointed interim chief, which they viewed as a pretext for getting around the local preference contained in the charter. But they reported these things, the violation of the charter, both at the press conference and at a meeting held the next day with City Manager Haynes, the very person charged with enforcing the charter and taking the remedial action.
What charter provision or statute or law do you say is violated if the majors are retaliated against for holding a press conference?
I think the press conference has two effects. One is the majors had been ordered by Chief Patterson not to communicate directly with City Hall, which was Mr. Haynes. So they were trying to communicate with Mr. Haynes through a public media. They were then called into a meeting with Mr. Haynes where they communicated to him directly their report of the violation.
It now, critical to your argument is that it would be considered a report to the appropriate law enforcement official by holding a press conference.
Yes, sir.
If that's not concluded, then there's nothing that prohibits, if that is not the conclusion, then there's nothing that prohibits Haynes from demoting these majors because they went out and had a press conference.
There was the second report directly to Mr. Haynes regardless of the press conference.
But my question was, unless it is concluded that holding a press conference is making a report to the proper law enforcement agency, there is nothing that prohibits Haynes from retaliating against these majors for the press conference.
Before the press conference?
For the press conference.
The Constitution, the constitutional argument, the Constitution prohibits retaliation or prohibits the government from taking official action that would prevent free speech. Now that's the last part of my argument.
Okay.
Not dealing directly with whistleblower. That's an alternative argument that I have and got jury findings on.
Are the jury findings on whistleblower, the Whistleblower Act and your constitutional tort contained in the same issues?
No.
The only issues laid out in the briefs were questions number 4 and 5. Are there any additional issues that
The whistleblower, the whistleblower issue is the first issue that we have. And I'm sorry, Judge, I can't tell you the exact numbers off the top of my head. But the second set of issues was the constitutional cause of action. They're very similar, but it is slightly different. But the jury found, basically on the same facts, a violation of both the constitutional right and retaliation for having reported the violation of the law. If I could just address your question one more time, see if I've got it, because I do think it's an awfully important feature of this, is that they made a report directly to the proper law enforcement authority, Mr. Haynes, in person at this second meeting, that is the 11:20 meeting. The evidence in the record of that report is found page 540. And at page 1, starting at 181 and going through page 195 and 196, and I'll just read that portion of the answer of one of the plaintiffs. If they brought in violation of the city charter, it's talking about the violation of the charter and the people being brought in. You'll see the 15 or 20 pages prior to this sort of a summary is him talking about the hiring of these other people, including Mr. Patterson's resource manager and acting chief, the personnel director, and so forth. If they brought in violation of the city charter, and we informed the mayor, and we informed the manager, and we informed the public in writing, now what else can you suggest we do? In other words, he's referring to these two meetings, how he and the other majors, Captain Carter, had informed the person in charge, City Manager Haynes, the person who is charged with the duty of enforcing the city charter, of the violation of law that was taking place, that is the appointment of these four or five people, without considering and taking the local preference into account. They were reporting a violation of the law. Now, the Laster case says that their report of the violation of the law must be in good faith, and even if it isn't a technical violation of law, if they think it is in good faith, then they have gotten into a protected situation. They have the protection of the Whistleblower Act. And the Laster case has some very sound reason for that, because they say the good faith requirement wouldn't be necessary. The statute wouldn't need to say in good faith if you can't have some leeway or latitude in reporting the violation of law. If there was an actual crime and you reported it, the Laster case argues it wouldn't care, it wouldn't make any difference if it was in good faith or for some other reason.
Mr. Coleman, would you comment on Mr. Gossman's argument that with regards to your theory of constructive discharge, all of your clients had exit interviews where they checked out voluntary retirement and they had some positive things to say about the city and other experience?
Yes, sir. I don't think you'll find that those exit interviews and those things they had to say preclude the fact that they felt like they had been constructively discharged and they were simply trying to get the partial or half pension that was being offered to get them out.
They would not have received the retirement or the pension had they said this was a lousy experience, you treated me wrong, you're violating the charter, or you've got these complaints?
They might have been able to get it anyway.
Well,
trying to take a chance.
Are those accrued benefits conditioned on what they say on that card?
I don't think it's conditioned on that, John. But if I could, you'll see how they could have felt like they needed to take that retirement benefit after the majors had been singled out by Mr. Haynes. And this is in the Paragon case.
Well, after they were singled out, were they not given responsibility to run the department?
Their responsibility was taken away from them.
I thought Mr. Gosselin stated, unless he misstated the facts or I heard him incorrectly, was that after the press conference, and then there was another meeting with the city manager, and the city manager took this black person away from the police department and said, "Majors, you run the department, and you report to me directly."
No, sir. No.
That did not happen?
No, sir. The record will show that after that second meeting, when the majors were singled out, the majors were then requested a meeting with Mr. Haynes. Mr. Haynes told them to bring an attorney to the meeting, drew up an agenda that said major's business is the first item. They then showed up at the meeting. He then blew up, had the attorney removed from the meeting, and the very next day wrote a public reprimand for the majors for having shown a startling deficiency in judgment. This was publicized on the radio, on TV, and caused a great deal of trouble for the majors. This was a false public reprimand because he had actually told them to bring the lawyer. They were reprimanded for having brought a lawyer to the meeting. Thereafter, and this gets more to the point of what you're saying, Mr. Haynes ordered a reorganization of the police department, and that's in quotes. He appointed Schultz, took Mr. Patterson off of the chief's position, appointed Mr. Schultz to the chief's position as acting chief, but under an express written instruction, which is our Exhibit 27, that the organization be accomplished and the majors be removed. Schultz agreed to do that only after he agreed to do that was he appointed. So this reorganization, in quotes, occurred. Now there really wasn't any reorganization at all. What they did is they went, Chief Schultz went from three divisions, headed by the majors, down to two divisions, and the majors' responsibilities were taken completely away from them. People who had been in charge of whole divisions of 100 or so officers suddenly found themselves in charge of the property room.
Was their salary affected?
Their salary was affected, but later. And this will get right to the point that you're getting at. Just before they took the final retirement, their salary was cut. The reorganization, after the majors had been removed, the reorganization provided then for deputy chiefs who were not brought in through examination, competitive examination, but were political appointees, took over these divisions. It was reorganized back to three divisions, just as it had been before. The department was exactly as it was before, with the sole exception that instead of majors for training, experience, and competitive examinations heading the divisions, you had deputy chiefs who were political appointees.
Was Mr. Schultz appointed from within the department?
Mr. Schultz was appointed from within the department.
Was he a major?
He was a captain. There was no other majors than the plaintiffs in this case.
What about the major that is still there?
Now, Major Bouillon he's the man who was taken from a substantial command position, put in charge of the services division, which is furnishing chairs and tables and so forth to the various police officers, cars, I suppose. He was not eligible to take the early retirement. He didn't have enough years in. So he's had to swallow all of this, which was a demotion. They removed their major's title. They were denied a departmental
pay raise. What is his title now? What is his title now?
He is now Captain Bouillon. And he would have taken it, but he couldn't. He wasn't eligible for it. They had at this point here, after the reorganization, told Major Parsons, get a retirement plan together. We want to get rid of as many of the older officers as we can. And Major Parsons got it together. It was presented to everyone, but the majors didn't sign up for it. They said, no, we want to stay and serve out and get our full retirement and continue to do a service to the public. Immediately following their refusal to sign up, they were demoted, they were denied the departmental pay raise, their pay was cut, finally. They then took the early retirement. That is what motivated them to take the early retirement. And that is kind of the chronology of the facts. They may have put down something, Your Honor, that on their exit interview, that said, well, we would recommend city employment. Or we can't think of anything negative to say about the city that we want to put down. But that jury considered all of that. And the jury weighed that contravening evidence and found in favor of the major on the issue. This is a no evidence point, not a substantial evidence, not a weighing of the insufficiency of the evidence, no evidence. This is, I contend, substantial, even overwhelming evidence of retaliation, a poignant retaliatory motive by Mr. Haynes.
Mr. Coleman, let me see if I understand your argument. You're saying that race is not, in this case, top side or bottom. Even though you or your cohort struck 12 out of 12 blacks from two juries, and they were objecting to a acting chief with what?
Yes, sir. Judge, if I could, that deals with my Batson point. In the Batson law, as it was developed by the United States Supreme Court, and as it has come to us through the Hernandez case, which I do place a great deal of reliance upon, and is in fact where our own jurisprudence came from, is that line of Supreme Court cases. In the Batson case, a lawyer is entitled to make his strike and have each strike measured according to the reasons for that particular strike. So the theory of Batson is, was the juror's right, the juror that was struck, was that juror's right denied to them? Were they denied the right to serve on the jury solely because of race, or now as we know, because of gender? If so, then that action cannot stand, and a Batson challenge is appropriate. Now, if you examine each strike, and where this is out of the Hernandez case, where the counsel's reason given for the particular strike is not racially motivated, or where it doesn't indicate any racial motivation for the strike, then that strike is allowed to stand. If it's racially neutral on its face, then that strike is allowed to stand. You move on to the next one.
How can it be race neutral if you've got 12 out of 12?
Yes, sir.
Isn't that suspect?
Judge, I can go right to that, and that is the very point of the Hernandez case, is that and what they call it is the disparate impact of the strikes taken as a whole cannot by itself or alone give rise to a claim of discrimination by the juror or a Batson claim. Numbers alone won't show intent to discriminate, and that's the burden.
So if the district attorney's office just happens, as it turns out, to strike 99.5% of all blacks on juries, it could come out that way.
Well, you have two different portions of the Batson test. You have a prima facie case, which has to be made before the jury panel is let go. In the prima facie case, they have to show some discrimination or some indication that discrimination takes place. Your evidence would be material for that.
Why is it material here?
It would be material for that here. In fact, that evidence was presented to the trial judge in the initial objection that was made by the city attorney at the time that the case was being tried.
You disagree that the trial court ruled that the trial court was not going to consider the jury composition in the earlier case?
Yes, sir.
That tell him the jury that is not before the court's consideration?
No, sir. He didn't rule to that effect. He said that he was not going to take or have any additional evidence and to have evidence of the first trial. They had subpoenaed 120 witnesses, which was all of the jurors. And he was faced with having a protracted disparate impact trial, the very thing sought to be avoided by Hernandez. And so he ruled that he wasn't going to have to listen to all those witnesses, and that he had before him, because he sat through the first voir dire, He saw how it was conducted and the manner in which it was conducted, and he knows what the findings that, you know, of who was struck and who wasn't. All of that is within his knowledge, and he found that there was no racial motivation for any of the strikes that were made of the jury that finally sat. Now, bear in mind, the first trial ended in mistrial. No one made a Batson objection to any of the strikes in the first trial. That was waived. That was concluded. That trial ended and stopped. The second trial, the Batson objection was made, and a Batson hearing was held wherein the attorney stated his objections. He had...
Do you agree that if there's a pretext as to any one of the jurors struck,
yes,
then the Batson challenge is good?
If the court can find that any one juror was struck because of race, an intentional racial discrimination, then the Batson challenge is good.
What was the reason for striking LaBeouf?
Mrs. LaBeouf was seen to be greeting and familiar with and seemed to know opposing counsel. And she was seen...
Was she questioned about that?
Judge, the voir dire examination was not preserved. There was no record on appeal of the voir dire examination.
So we accept Ms. LaBeouf's testimony at the Batson hearing that she was not questioned about that.
I think you have to accept the judge's finding that she was seen chatting with opposing counsel, or greetings with opposing counsel.
Am I mistaken? I thought that was the attorney's statement that he thought she knew him.
Yes, sir. The judge found that. And in the absence of a statement of facts, there is a presumption that the evidence contained in that statement of facts would support the judge's finding. From his view of the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances surrounding voir dire.
I assume that would be your same answer for, is it LaPointe, whoever
Richard was LaPointe.
Who knew the bailiff or something?
Richard LaPointe knew the bailiff, but he also indicated that he was not, that he had had, I believe he's the one who had had a problem with the city inspector, who he thought was being overzealous in inspecting his property. He indicated an attitude adverse to the strict enforcement of the law that we were trying to urge, that is the strict enforcement of the city charter. So his strike was on the basis of his attitude against our case, against our theory of the case.
Wouldn't that be an attitude adverse to the city?
It perhaps would have been, Judge, but we were looking for people who would require strict enforcement of the law, because we were insisting on strict enforcement of the city charter. That was the way we had perceived it, and we struck two jurors on that theory that they did not exhibit an attitude that would be supportive of strict enforcement of the law. We struck a juror who did not appear to understand or know or be able to comprehend the proceedings due to lack of education. We struck a juror who was getting ready to be shipped out to Desert Storm, he thought, and told us at the voir dire. They were having the reforging operation right outside the courthouse. You could look right out the window and see everybody getting on the ships to go to Arabia. And we had a soldier on our jury that he thought was going to be chawed up within a week. Those were our strikes. There's no racial motivation in any of those strikes. The judge heard it. He saw it. He found it. And the law is that unless there is something more than a disparate impact, this is the Hernandez case, and you've got to have something more than a disparate impact to find intentional racial motivation.
As to LaBeouf, if the trial court accepting that the lawyer had some reason to believe that LaBeouf knew the opposing counsel, without questioning LaBeouf at all about any of that, had the court accepted evidence that in the previous trial 100% of the plaintiff's strikes had been used against Black Menard, and that 100% of the strikes that plaintiffs had in the second trial were used against Black Menard, would the judge abuse his discretion, or rather would it be, I can't remember the exact words that you used.
You have to go to substantially correct.
Substantially. Would the judge have been substantially correct in permitting above to have been stricken?
Yes. Judge, what the trial judge has to do is he has to look at the strike and determine, does he believe the lawyer? In other words, he has to make, does he believe the explanation the lawyer has given? He has to make a factual determination at that point. Unless it's clearly erroneous, that's the phrase we're looking for. Unless it's clearly erroneous, then the trier of fact's determination is final. The trier of fact looks at the explanation given by the attorney, and if it is on its face racially neutral, that is, if it could apply to a person of any race, then, and he believes it, then that is an end of the matter. That's the very phrase used in Hernandez. If it's on its face racially neutral, then that's an end to the matter. You don't go into any further evidence of pretext or evidence of numbers or evidence of disparate impact. All of that is out because the lawyer's entitled to a strike. And he's entitled to a strike for any reason he wants to make it, save and except race or gender.
So there really isn't any appellate review.
There isn't.
Even whether it's all blacks or struck.
Yes, there are. There
as long as the trial judge believes that this is not a pretextual explanation for striking a minority juror.
Well, the appellate review is if the trial judge's finding is clearly erroneous.
But you just said that the trial judge can believe the lawyer that this is not a pretextual reason, and that's the end of it.
That's right.
Regardless of disparate impact.
That's
so there is no appellate review under those circumstances.
No, Judge. If there are two differing views of the evidence that the trial judge could pick from, and he picks one rather than the other, then the finding can't be clearly erroneous. That's sort of the way that you're trying to get at. I didn't get to my constitutional argument, Your Honor, but I'll leave that to the briefs.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Do the petitioners have any rebuttals on this?
May it please the court, I'll try to hit just the high points of the argument. First of all, with regard to Judge Enoch, finding number 20 with regard to Senator LaBeouf is false because Mr. Kirk testified in the statement on the Batson hearing that he did not observe her talking with anyone, that he just somebody reported this to him that they were friends. So that finding is wrong by the trial court. In answer to Justice Gonzalez's question about whether I had cited improper evidence concerning the majors, Judge Gonzalez, Defendant's Exhibit Number 1 was a letter dated January 22, 1987. It was a statement to the four majors and the Beaumont Police Department concerning the news conference held by the staff officers of the Beaumont Police Department. This was 3 days after the press conference. And this was a letter from Al Haynes, the city manager, to the police officers. He said, and I won't repeat the whole letter, but basically he said there will be no changes in operational procedure, policy structure, or organization without a recommendation from the majority of the majors and without my approval, which is what I told the court. He said, Mr. Patterson will be delegating virtually all operational decisions of the police department to the majors. And he said, and thirdly, I will be scheduling weekly meetings with you and the interim chief. At these meetings, any item relating to approvals and any concerns of yours and any other staff officer will be heard. So that was what he told the majors in a letter of dated January the 22nd, Defendant's Exhibit Number 1.
Did he, in fact, invite them to bring their attorneys over to his staff meeting?
Your Honor, he said he did not remember doing that. They said, well, you tell it. There was no question that they had never told him in advance that they were bringing an attorney to this meeting. And he told them at this meeting, he said, if you want to discuss with your attorney, I'll be happy to do so, but let's conduct a staff meeting first, and then we'll talk with your attorney. And Major Billiard said, no, we're going to discuss the attorney first. And he said, no, This staff meeting is first. You ask your attorney to leave. That's what happened. But he said, I would be willing, and he testified, I told him I would be willing to meet with you and your attorney at any time if you set me up in advance. Notify me in advance. And they never take him up on that offer. I would also like to point out that the majors in the selection of police chief, George Schultz, who was a captain in the police department, was ultimately appointed. It was as a result of this Blue Ribbon Committee that City Manager Al Haynes applied. The majors, three of the four majors, applied for the job, but they dropped out along the way because they would not undergo the psychological testing that was required of all candidates. They said they would not do it, and he said, well, that's the requirement. Everybody has to go through a psychological testing. So they dropped out, and so they were not considered for the police chief. With regard to the early retirement, I would like to simply point out that this was not early retirement just for the four majors or the thing. This was early retirement for 40 city employees. Al Haynes testified he would not have paid all this money just to get rid of one or two or three people. This was early retirement for 40 city employees all across the board, police department, water department, everything else. These people took early retirement, and that's what they said on their informant exit interview. Every one of them said, voluntary retirement, and said what I told you they said. Thank you, Your Honor. Everything is good.
Thank you, General. That concludes the argument in the second clause. The court will take another brief recess.